So when did you get down to New York?
Oh, around noon.
Ah, did you take the shuttle?
Yes.
Is it working all right with the snow?
Yep. All weather, even heavy snow.
I heard that there were some delays, but I think that was probably the result of the airports down south being closed.
Right.
Friendship was closed.
We were prepared to jump in the car and come if we missed the plane.
What is the occasion at the library tonight?
It's a lecture series, and I'll be talking a little bit about that book, but also about a research project that I did that involved running tracks some years ago.
Running tracks?
That's right.
What is a running track? You mean like feet running?
That's right. The design of a running track, which in this case resulted in a track design which can reduce injuries but also improve running performance. And it's finally became the design that was used for a track produced at Harvard and then also at Madison Square Garden in New York.
So you are really an inventor, huh?
Yes. Project that I mentioned about the running track was something that I did with Peter Green, who was a graduate student and then a postdoctoral fellow with me in my laboratory at Harvard. We were asked to figure out what would be the best way to make a running track which could be safe to run on but also have good performance.
Are you yourself an athlete and a runner? Or was this a scholarly application?
It was mostly a scholarly application. I prefer bicycling to running when I can.
I see you as inventing a stationary bicycle that has lots of bells and whistles and things. Is that right?
Not a stationary bicycle. I did think once about a flying rowing machine, however. A machine which would actually propel you up in the air and give you the excitement of flying through the air as you rode it.
Didn't they try that in 1904?
Perhaps they did. This one would work by a cheating principle. It would have some water ballast so that you could enjoy flying without supporting your entire weight.
Well, I'm beginning to understand a little bit about you and loving a little Egypt and possibly some of the motivation for the book. This was a wonderful novel. I saw echoes of Mark Helprin's Winter's Tale in there, and I saw echoes of The Cider House Rules by John Irving, and yet you still have a distinctive voice. I think the thing that reminded me of Winter's Tale, did you read the book, by the way?
No.
Well, it's also takes place over a bygone era, although I think it extends for 100 years. But the interesting thing about it was that there would be these marvelous descriptions of food as they sat down to eat. Of course, all the way through Loving Little Egypt, you had these marvelous descriptions of what was on the dinner table and what they were eating at a given time. Helprin also did that. That was kind of reminiscent in some respects. I'm surprised you haven't read that book. I think you would like it now, especially that you have finished Loving Little Egypt.
Yes, well, I'll go out and get it right away. I think that books that you enjoy often do have good food in them or something else that's just an ordinary pleasure that comes by that readers can enjoy along with the plot and the characters and whatever else is happening.
Well, reflecting your own taste and interest, I would assume. Any book probably has things in there that you enjoy and interest you. Tell me how you got the idea for Loving Little Egypt and what instigated to this book.
I can't remember how I got the idea for the book. It crystallized and I recalled the phone freaks that I remember being active when I was in college. These were kids who took over the telephones in the early 60s, and then toward the, I guess, middle and late 60s, they got even more active. And I remember hearing stories about them, although I never met one or knew one. I thought it was a fantastic possibility that just by making noises into the telephone and whistling, that kids my own age were learning how to outwit devices that other people had put there, and not knowing that anyone would ever be interested in figuring out the codes.
Is that true? The tongue clicks could actually do that?
In my book, I attributed the possibility of clicks made with the tongue to cause the signaling equipment to listen and make changes and to be able to route the telephone experimenters throughout the country. It's barely plausible that this might have been possible at the time that I said.
Well, after reading Living Little Egypt, I did a lot of tongue clicking into my telephone and nothing worked. Still got my bill.
Banging up and down on the receiver can do something of the same nature. And those who are clever at it say that there are routes to be found even now through the telephone networks. They're a lot more canny than they were in either the 60s or in the 20s, however.
Well, these kids who are predominantly blind in the novel also reminded me of the youngsters who use computers today, too. They're kind of a forerunner of that as well, isn't that true?
Yes, I suppose it is. I was looking for something in this book, a world that would not be our obvious, ordinary world that we see all the time. A world really hidden except to people who have an understanding of how to get there. That was what made the telephone freaking such a reasonable possibility for me. I also knew that the phone freaks of my own generation were mostly blind, the earliest ones. and they learned to do tricks with the telephone partly out of partly for the thrill of it and also to find ways of staying in touch with their friends indefinitely instead of just in short calls and calls of infinite length.
Didn't you have some experience teaching at the Perkins School for the Blind?
Yes, I did, just on a volunteer basis. I went several times to the Perkins School and took part in a physics class there, and had the great enjoyment of meeting and becoming friends with students in the class who either were blind or partially sighted. These kids had an enormous amount of enthusiasm and goodwill for the subject we were talking about, and they tell me things that I didn't know that they had heard about that they wanted to know more about. The things that I did with them involved experiments that they could understand, that they could really feel. For example, we did some experiments with electricity where they cranked a Van de Graaff generator to bring up a charge on a sphere and could feel the electric sparks jumping from their fingers to the sphere. And they also enjoyed an experiment that involved the mechanical properties of frog's muscle, where we had a force transducer that could make an acoustic signal that they could hear, so that when they could tell by the pitch of the whistle what the muscle was doing. And I left each of those sessions with a feeling of real exhilaration because of their enthusiasm and their interest in not only the things that they knew about, but things that I wanted to tell them about.
Did you pattern some of the characters in your novel after some of the youngsters you saw or met at Perkins?
Yes, I did, but not making a specific identification of one person in the novel with one person in real life. Still, I found many of the characteristics of curiosity and enthusiasm in the real children, those were the characteristics that I wanted to put into the characters in my book.
Now, tell me this. Why is it that Alexander Graham Bell in the novel comes off so well and Thomas Edison does not?
I made an effort to be very careful to keep the fictional characters true to the characters of the real people. And so I read several biographies and other materials that I could find about each of the people who are represented in the book under their own names. And I found that that Bell really was a genuine and thoughtful and loving man. He loved his family above everything else, and they gave him that same love back again. He also had many other attractive characteristics, including generosity with the money that he had from prizes and royalties, and generosity with his time in supporting the activities of many people who remembered him later in their writings very fondly. On the other hand, Edison is not remembered as a sympathetic character. what I represented about him in the book is mostly true. There's very little that I've made up about Edison that's in the book. Edison really did provide a great deal of difficulty for his family, and he was a severe character. And if I've made him unsympathetic in the book, I only find him that way in his biographies as well.
What about Sparky Edison?
I've created a character in the book, Sparky, who is Edison's son. And while Edison actually had more than one child, the characteristics that Sparky has are ones that are not very far from the characteristics of some of Edison's children. That is, people who Edison's children did feel a regret that their father was not more of a kind and concerned person. So I've given Sparky some of the characteristics that I imagine that Edison's children had, and yet I haven't represented Sparky as any one particular person.
Now, you say these characters, at least, are true to life, but yet there are so many fictional elements. For example, they invented all of these outrageous inventions, some of which obviously weren't going to fly. I mean, how did that... Haven't you confused us? I mean, here you have an accurate portrayal, perhaps, of Edison and Bell, and yet they do all sorts of things that they never did.
There are some imaginary inventions in the book, as well as many real ones. And if I had to say about what fraction of the inventions were real and what fraction were imagined, the numbers would come out about maybe 50-50. That is, in talking about Bell, for example, I attributed to Bell some inventions that that sound preposterous, but were actually things that he was working on. For example, Bell did work on a device which he called a vacuum jacket, which was to support life in a person whose breathing was not proceeding properly. And
Is that a forerunner of the Iron Lung?
Yes, it is a forerunner of the Iron Lung, and Bell really did do such a development, although it was a development which was not taken up and followed successfully on from the point that Bell invented it. Another example of a real Bell invention is the hydroplane, which Bell called a hydrodrome, actually a hydrofoil boat that Bell built and operated at very high speeds. This boat could go as high as 70 miles an hour. And Bell hoped that this would be a successful craft for going across the Atlantic. He thought of it as the Zeppelin of the ocean. It would carry passengers above the waves and on a smooth flight across the ocean and put an end to seasickness. So this appears in my book and may seem preposterous when, along with some of the other things that come along that I've attributed to Bell, for example, that seem equally preposterous and are, in fact, made up. An example of such a thing is my attribution to Bell of a flying machine which works by the principle of melting ice. In the book, I propose that Bell has observed that cold currents of air descend away from a block of ice, and that this can be used as a principle to produce thrust. And a machine operating this way would work with ice cubes, causing it to fly up in the air.
Well, I see no reason why that wouldn't work. Now, tell me a little bit about yourself. You're a very unusual man to be writing fiction. This is your third work of fiction, although you've written a number of scholarly books, I know, or treatises of some sort. But you are a professor of applied mechanics and biology at Harvard. How is it you have been able to combine a scientific career with that of a literary career? People just don't do that.
I'll agree that that's not a usual thing for a scientist to do. And in fact, scientists and applied scientists are more likely to be interested in visual art or even more generally in music. And they may be performers or even composers. But writing, and particularly writing fiction, is not something that ordinarily happens along with science or more specifically the kind of applied science that I'm involved in. I do find, though, that the material for fiction, the ideas for fiction, are everywhere, and I don't see that it's impossible to find those ideas attached to science. And in fact, science has some wonderful themes for fiction that are just lying there ready to be used, and the fact that they may be hidden from people other than scientists just because only scientists know about them.
Well, let's go back. You were born where?
I was born in Dayton, Ohio, but my parents moved to Massachusetts and to the Boston area very shortly after I was born. So really, I've only known the Boston area since I first opened my eyes.
Well, what sort of family did you have? Was it a literary household?
My mother was and was interested in writing all the time that I was growing up, and my father is a scientist. He is an applied scientist, to one of the team, it turns out, who developed the first machine for making liquid gases, liquid nitrogen, for example. And he has had a long career in applied science as president of the Arthur D. Little Company most recently. This is a company that does research on industrial problems for large companies.
So, your mother with the literary mind and your father with the scientific mind, I can see you have the best of both, right? Runs in your genes.
Yes, indeed. And my sister, Jean, is a professor of literature at University of Massachusetts at Boston. And so she's also followed that direction. My youngest sister, Nancy, is a musician and also a craftsman. She builds very beautiful cases for instruments in her house. She's married to a concert musician, Ed Swanborn, who often appears on the radio playing keyboard instruments.
Well, it sounds like you have a lot of versatility in your family. You studied what? You went to MIT, didn't you?
Yes.
What did you study there?
I studied aerodynamics and the applications of fluid mechanics to various things, and it was at MIT that I developed an interest in applying fluid mechanics to biology. This was really made more specific by my doctoral thesis, which was concerned with the design of a machine for inflating and deflating a balloon in the aorta in order to reduce the workload on a failing heart. So it's a device called the intra-aortic balloon and helps people get over heart attacks.
Did you patent that?
No, and in fact, it wasn't my idea. I worked on this project with Asher Shapiro, a professor at MIT, who was interested in the fluid mechanics of flow of blood around the device. And together, we pursued that and worked out a particular way in which the device should be used in order to make it work as well as it does now.
Well, somewhere along the line, you also studied some creative writing, didn't you?
Yes. I was allowed by MIT to offer a minor in English as part of my PhD work. And that right away goes to point out how MIT was and still is an open-minded sort of place. Would have understood it better, I think, if I had done a minor in mathematics or another physical subject, perhaps. But they said, well, nobody ever did a minor in English before, so you go off and do that if that's what you'd like to do. And as I did, I studied writing with Theodore Morrison at Harvard. And after three courses with Morrison, all writing on the same project, he suggested that it was finished and he'd be willing to try to find a publisher for it.
Wow, that turned out to be your first book, McKay's Bees. Is that right?
No, that my first book was called Principles of American Nuclear Chemistry, and that was a novel about the atomic bomb project. That was published in 1970, and Theodore Morrison was the one who actually put me in touch with my editor for that book, Peter Davison.
Who's the publisher?
That was published by Atlantic Little Brown in Boston.
Did the title throw people off at all?
Yes, it did. we took a chance with the title, thinking that people might wander into the store and say, I'm looking for a book and I can't remember the title, but it sounds something like a textbook. And at that point, the person behind the counter would go and find it. And in fact, it worked somewhat that way. And the English publisher insisted on changing the title, however, because they also published textbooks, and so it would have backfired.
But what did they call it?
They called it a random state, which is a phrase from the book, and is that was the title that was used in England.
Does the publication of the novels help with regard to the publish or perish syndrome at Harvard, or doesn't it count?
It's a separate activity, and I think that it's best to keep such things separate. I'm always alert to to the possibility that people might be wondering when I'm talking about a project from applied science whether I'm making that up also. So it's just as well that I really do have quite a big wall between these various different aspects of my life, and one doesn't have much to do with the other.
Well, they can also say, hey, there's that McMahon, he's writing another novel when he should be doing a scholarly treatise on applied science, right?
Yeah, so I do...
Wasting all that time?
There is a lot of time to do all the things that one really wants to do, and I often work on my novel writing activities in the morning and then get on my bicycle and head into work, and I find that it's a very great change, and a change that can actually lead to benefits in both directions, to come into work and be separate from the writing by the time I get there. I need the 45 minutes or so of riding in order to make the transition, but once I have it, I find that my regular job at school is extremely pleasant because it has other people attached to it in a very nice and important way, and that the life of a writer is so very, very solitary that I wouldn't want to have that life all the time.
Well, you're certainly an unusual guy, Tom McMahon. I am pronouncing the name correctly, McMahon.
Yes.
I really enjoyed reading Loving Little Egypt. It was a wonderful book. There are a lot of funny parts to it. I enjoyed it fully. I certainly appreciate that you took the time to stop in here. I know your schedule is probably very busy with what you have going tonight and probably other appointments and so forth, but I want to thank you very much for spending the time with me.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed it.